Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. Your Honors, this case comes to us on ruling on a motion for summary judgment involving a claim for illegal secondary boycott activities by the union in connection with a strike it had, a long-term strike it had with the Congress Hotel. We're dealing with nine separate customers we allege in the complaint had been illegally boycotted by the union with illegal tactics that the United States Congress has prohibited through Section 8B42B, which I'll abbreviate for purposes of oral argument as Section 8B. This case has some importance because it will be what I consider to be somewhat of a roadmap for future labor disputes. The customers that were involved in this case were each involved with very aggressive type of activities that you do not normally see in some of the cases. Direct confrontations, intimidating tactics, disruptions of businesses. In many of the instances, we have multiple strikers and union organizers that are appearing inside a business and engaging in protest activity, disrupting business affairs. And we cite plenty of cases in our briefs where cases have frowned upon that. Even in the abortion cases, there are restrictions in terms of what protesters can and cannot do in protesting the anti-abortion rhetoric that they...
Does Servet and Drew Bartolo control this case?
I'm sorry?
I'll speak louder and I'll ask you to do the same. Does Servet and DiBartolo control this case?
I think in many respects it does. And from our perspective, DiBartolo is a good guideline in terms of what this case is not about. Many of the facts that are present in DiBartolo are not here. In DiBartolo, all we had was a group of strikers or union representatives that are standing outside a shopping mall for 3 weeks, the entrances, and passing out handbills. There is no direct confrontations that are taking place. There is no intimidating tactics that are taking place, nor is there any disruption of the business. In one instance, we have with the merchandise matter, we have the union sending out flyers, which is not present in DiBartolo, where they are asking the public to call directly somebody who had nothing to do with the housing arrangement for the neocon affair, Mr. Kennedy. And in DiBartolo, we didn't have that. DiBartolo, all they said is, don't shop at the mall, and if you do shop at the mall, please express your support for the union.
Well, for a lot of years, the union, I guess union members have been picketing the Congress, right?
They have. But that's a primary picket in front of the hotel, and we don't dispute that they have a right to do that.
So are you saying then that what they were doing was similar to what was going on in Servet and DiBartolo at the time before this other stuff started?
I'm saying with regard to the activities that took place with the secondaries?
No. I'm talking about all this started, but whenever this external stuff that you're talking about started. But before that time, what they appeared to be doing was the same thing that was going on in DiBartolo and Servet.
I think
similar to it.
In 2005 is when we had the first boycott activity, and that's with the AgLab case, where they delivered the Commodore. Up until that time, the activities of the union had largely been limited to simply picketing in front of the hotel. There is no evidence in the record that we pointed out, or that the union pointed out, of the union going to secondary businesses, our customers, and asking them to support the strike. The activities were largely limited to what took place in front of the hotel, and that is striking activities.
Now, were there other activities in the hotel, such as a restaurant or maybe shops or anything like that?
I don't know. I think they're all run directly by the hotel. If your question is whether or not they're separate businesses that are at least two in order, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they're run by the hotel. But the focus of our facts here are how different they are to DiBartolo and Servet. In Servet, for example, they talked to the manager. There's no evidence at all on Servet that they forced themselves into this business and virtually said, you meet with us. In one instance, we have instances where the union, six or seven union representatives, walk in to the facility and they refuse to leave until police are called. And then they appear a second time without any evidence whatsoever that they were invited a second time, forcing the official of that event to meet with them in the basement in order to satisfy their fears.
I thought that was a voluntary meeting.
I would suggest in the record that there is no evidence that it was necessarily voluntary. From the circumstances, the first meeting, they appeared without any indication that it was a planned meeting, and in fact, they were told.
That's not a bullhorn, is it?
Maybe my time is up. They appeared without any indication that it was an invitation to appear. They stayed until such time as the police were threatened to be called. The police, in fact, were called, but
weren't
they
in a place that the public has access to?
I'm sorry?
Weren't they in a place that the public has access to?
Limited access. I would describe it as a situation where, much like any other business, where people set up a business for the purposes of selling whatever craft or service they have. In terms of whether or not there's a public right to just walk in and demonstrate and protest, I would contest whether or not they have the right to do that. And again, certainly in the abortion case that the Supreme Court has heard in the last few years, abortion protesters don't have a right to just walk into the clinic and protest, even though the clinic itself may be open to anybody who has business with regard to abortion activities.
Well, just showing up unannounced without an invitation doesn't violate the statute.
No, it doesn't. And that's why the facts surrounding all of these incidents are so important. We just can't describe this as a simple call to arms saying, hey, support us in this boycott. You have to look at all the other facts. For instance, in Tangle, we have an instance where they are what appears to be secretly somehow getting into the building without a true indication of why they're there. They're sneaking into a secured building, leaving literature throughout the building, embarrassing this one-person show who's running the Tango event. And then when they meet with him, he finally says, okay, I'll meet with him. Now, before that, he said, I don't want your literature. I don't want to talk to you. He finally, after being confronted with all this literature inside his building, being embarrassed, he says, okay, I'll agree to meet. And when he meets, what happens? Well, that's when the real confrontation occurs. He's very thorough in description in describing the appearance of this union official.
I'm troubled by your use of that term confrontation. A meeting can be a confrontation. It seems to me that the presence and the interaction itself, it's hard to say that that's an illegal secondary action. It seems to me it takes something more than just the presence.
I think when he describes his reaction, number one, the color of her face changing. Number two, the fact that she was very aggressive, she was loud, and then he said, "I was in fear. I was to the point where I was preparing to call the police." And I think his reaction is indicative of what took place in this case. That's undisputed with regard to his reaction. No one has contested the fact that there was a.
We don't measure First Amendment issues, and this statute has to be interpreted with First Amendment values in mind. That's clear from the Supreme Court's case law, but we don't measure these kinds of claims by virtue of the reaction or by reference to the reaction. That's a heckler's veto problem.
I think
so. You know, the fact that he reacted to it the way that he did isn't the proper measure.
Correct, but when we look at the corroborating circumstances surrounding it, we have six or seven officials that are coming in here. We have an individual who objectively described her face changing.
Right, and we don't evaluate it based on changes in complexion. That's just not a good standard for purposes of these claims. The statute doesn't prohibit aggressive secondary persuasion.
But
it prohibits threats and coercion.
Correct. And so when describing a confrontation, that's the basis for my description of a confrontation. It's supported by the testimony of the individual making that description.
You're contending that the trier of fact could infer that it was threatening or coercive based on the facts that you've put into the record?
That's correct.
Now, while you're on the Tango Institute, you write about the hacking of the internet site. Was that linked to
no.
the union?
No. It was the testimony of the individual that said, for Tango, I think it was, where he said shortly after one of the union officials signed up for the internet, my website had been hacked. And he said, I can't attribute that to the union.
It's just a temporal event.
Just a temporal. And that was his accusation that I don't know if it was a union, but I found it to be. I don't think he used the word ironic, but he described it somewhat as ironic. The circumstances happened at that point in time. So we're not necessarily making a claim that union hacked it, but that was his testimony that, you know, once I got done with all this, now I find that my website had been hacked. The point with Tango, though, is that if you look at the circumstances of his particular case, he's a one-person show having to deal with all these types of union activities, people sneaking into his secured office building, leaving this literature.
There may be a basis for trespass prosecutions or disorderly conduct prosecutions by virtue of the kind of conduct that was going on here, but I just don't know that it meets the standard for an unfair labor practice because the statute does permit this kind of aggressive secondary activity.
I would say that there comes a point where it crosses a line, and the Supreme Court in DiBartolo made reference to the fact that you have three types of activities that are prohibited: restraining activity, threatening activity, or coercive activity. And one point that the Supreme Court made clear is that you may have a right to communicate, but once you start mixing that communication with coercive activity, and I believe that the court referenced the fact that the reason why picketing was illegal under Section 8B was because it involved both a mixture of conduct and communication.
Right. Picketing blocks entry. You know, and we have no evidence of blocked entry here.
No, and we're not suggesting there's any picketing, but there's somewhere between the picketing and the right to just simply pass out literature like there was in DiBartolo, you can cross the line. And we pointed out one of the cases that I thought did a good example of identifying a factual distinction between permitted and non-permitted activity was the Pi case. In Pi, they indicated that was a group shopping where they had sent a number of different unions into the store to buy items and with large denomination of bills and basically disrupt the business. That's what they described it as. And at that point, what happened was is they said, look, you can't go in there and disrupt a business like that and claim that to be protected activity. That's a disruption. And they even suggested that there was two messages that were being sent in Pi. Number one, that they had the power to do this, and they had the power to do it at any time. And number two, that if you keep doing business with Bush, this is what's going to happen. That's the message that was sent. Now, it was orderly.
What evidence of business disruption is there with respect to any of these secondaries?
Oh, with regard to, we have the Ag Lab case where they delivered the cow manure, and they tried to return it back to the individual, and one individual came out of his office and basically followed the union out of the building and said, the union said, we're not taking it. That's
yeah, but no business is being disrupted in a meaningful way like the other case where there was actual sort of inundation of sham purchasing.
Tango. One morning he was receiving calls every 10 minutes. Top model. You have the in 6 hours.
Didn't Tango contend that it lost a substantial amount of membership?
He said it destroyed him. I think it was like 70. I think it was 70%.
Still in business, though, aren't they?
It's a kind of a volunteer organization, and he said when he had to move this on such a short notice, membership dropped, and he had additional costs in connection with all of that.
I assume that when the various, you know, the list 9 incidents, I was looking for one of them that said, you know what, you're right, those people are not getting paid enough and we're going to cancel. Did anybody say that, or was it always in a reaction to it, or the fear or concern or embarrassment or whatever I don't want to say threatened, was suggested,
whatever,
encountered, whatever we want to talk about. Is there anyone that said that you're right, we're going to cancel?
Of the 9 customers that are issued right here, I don't think any of them said, we agree with what you're saying, we're going to support you. Mm-hmm. If there's no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my
time.
Thank
you. Ms. Reynolds.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court. Your Honors, there is one question that the Court must keep coming back to as it considers the hotel's arguments in this case. And that question is dictated by DiBartolo. The Court has to keep asking itself, is the hotel's proposed interpretation of coerce and threaten the only possible interpretation? Or can this statute be interpreted in some other way that would not reach the communications that the union made in this case? And in interpreting 8B42B, the Court is going to look to the language and the legislative history. The language is vague, as the Supreme Court observed, but the legislative history is not vague. The legislative
I guess what troubles me about your argument is that this was done on summary judgment, and there were facts in the record about conduct, and I have doubt about whether the district judge construed those facts favorably toward the hotel's position, that there could be some inferences drawn that would show that these were coercive activities or threatening activities.
Well, Your Honor, I believe this case is exactly the kind of case where summary judgment is the appropriate place for disposition, because it's the obligation of the court to follow the NLRB versus Catholic Bishop principle and to make a careful construction of this statute.
Well, let's take the Tango situation, mm-hmm. the facts of Tango. Executive director, whatever his title was, is just peppered with these emails, phone calls, and so on and so forth. And literature gets into an area that is not open to the public, that arguably was gained by trespass. That could be a pretty intimidating prospect for an operator of an enterprise like that to face that onslaught. Couldn't that be inferred to be intimidating or coercive?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Actually, the union in DiBartolo was engaged in trespass. And if you read the Supreme Court's first decision, what they call DiBartolo 1, which was issued in 1983 and involved, it arose out of the same factual situation, the court observes that these handbillers were there handbilling for 3 weeks until they were enjoined by a state court, and that was when it stopped. So there was trespass on private property in the handbilling at the mall in that case.
What was the private property?
The private property was the mall. They were outside the mall.
The mall.
They were outside the mall. They were in the exterior, and management, I don't recall from that case, but I don't think management told them to leave, or told them that they were trespassing until such point as they got the injunction.
Well, I would assume that at the point when they filed for the injunction, the union would have understood that as a demand to leave, but they continued. The record, I don't know if there's a reflection in the decision as to whether there were demands before that. I would disagree also that Tango was peppered with emails. I think there was evidence of two or three total written communications, including email, fax, and a letter. And the record does not reflect how the union got into that building, but it does reflect that there were 100 businesses located in Tango's building. So it's not unusual in that situation for the main door to be opening and closing. You come to attempt to visit the Tango office and someone else is going in or out. I don't think it requires or permits the inference that my opponent suggested, that the union snuck in or used some kind of improper means to.
What about the literature got into that place, into a public area of that office? You contest that?
The The testimony of Mr. Roldan was that it was dropped off at his office door. And so that does mean the union came into this building, but what I'm saying is since there are 100 offices, 100 different businesses in there, it's very possible that they simply walked in as somebody else was opening the door.
I would like to focus on DiBartolo and Servette, because those seem to be the centerpiece of your appeal. In each of those cases, picketing, I guess it was, I'm not sure what they did at Servette. Was it any picketing there?
No,
okay.
It was him.
So it's all leafleting, whatever you want to call it. In each case, it was confined to those locations. And it seems to me that's exactly what was going on before this, I'll call it extracurricular activity, took place at the Congress. They were picketing, which is okay, on site, primary. I'm sure they had encounters, we won't call them coercion or confrontation, encounters with the people who ran the hotel, trying to negotiate and do other things, which failed. So it seems to me that's exactly what with DiBartolo. They're protesting, 3 weeks of leafleting, and it's the mall itself that's the owner of the mall. That's the one that they're dealing with. Same with Servette. That's a grocery store of some kind. There is one product line in there that they wanted people to not buy, not purchase. And so they're passing it out. But they're encountering customers who are going to the mall or going to the grocery store. The same thing all of the picketing you did for years was encountering people who were going to stay at the hotel, I presume. And that wasn't working. So it seems to me there's a gap here beyond DiBartolo and Servette. And that's what I think Judge Tender was focusing on. Is there something more than DiBartolo and Servette? And the question is, does that arise to coercion or something else, or is it just a more aggressive way of leafleting? And the reason I asked the other side, was there anyone, did anyone change their mind and say, you know what, you're right, we're not paying them enough? It seems that every reason people changed was they were worried about what's going to happen if they don't. And there's going to be something more when they have their event or when they have people coming or with the restaurant thing. All of these things that were kind of an external attack. I don't want to use any of the words like that. An external something, encounter or effort.
I'd like to make two responses to that, if I may, Your Honor. One is, although I don't believe any of these customers said, yes, we are canceling because we agree with your position in the strike, a number of them did express concern that their constituents would agree with the union's position. For example, the film festival director didn't want the stars to be embarrassed, and she likened it to when she was wearing a fur coat and there were animal rights activists criticizing her for wearing fur. She didn't want the embarrassing message to stars at this gala that, you know, you are involved in an unjust labor situation.
But there's going to be something more than leafleting. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what the picket situation was at that stage.
There was no threat of picketing, Your Honor. There was never any...
No. I'm not talking about secondary. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about at the hotel.
Well, yes, there was picketing at the hotel throughout this time.
Yeah, that was always going on. So they're going to encounter that.
Weren't there threats to go to member businesses and homes of others, homes of individuals, homes of board members, things like that?
There were no threats to go to homes. None at all. That's correct. The only testimony about homes is the boycott director testified that occasionally the addresses that the union would find, say, on the web for persons affiliated with the various groups, they would go there to do a get delegation, and occasionally it would turn out to be a home address. And when that happened, they did not ring the doorbell, but they left a packet of information.
But the point is, there's no evidence that this was a triumph of persuasion. It shows every sign of being a triumph of harassment, and that's the question that's confronting us today about whether harassment of this kind is actionable as an unfair labor practice or is protected by the First Amendment.
No, I would disagree, Your Honor. If you look at this court's decision in 2012 in Carpet Service International, which is cited in our brief, that involved a threat of commonsitis picketing, which is lawful activity, and the union in that case informed the general contractor, as long as you keep using this subcontractor, we are going to be doing commonsitis picket at your job site. And this court described that by saying that the union simply attempted to persuade the general contractor. And the court used the word persuade by stating what the local's future course
persuade,
of action
would
be.
But not in the sense that mm-hmm. most of us understand that word. In other words, persuade mm-hmm. them that the point of view is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's to persuade them to take action to terminate the association with the struck employer. But
exactly, Your Honor. And the court
which is
found
a different
that
form of persuasion. So that I think that was the import of Judge Manion's mm-hmm. question. Well, nobody's persuaded here that this mm-hmm. Position is necessarily mm-hmm. correct. That's not a prerequisite. The
certainly.
Persuasion is being exerted in a different sense to try to bring about a cancellation of the contract.
I agree, and this court has found that that kind of persuasion is lawful. And I'd like to go back to Judge Tinder's question about summary judgment. If this the case is sent to trial, the court is placing in the jury's hands the question of what the words coerce and threaten mean.
Well, there would be jury instructions.
And we do that all the time.
There would, but this is a First Amendment inflected case. We're trying to avoid the First Amendment conflict. And
So are things like mm-hmm. criminal charges of coercion, threats, things of that nature, bumps up against the First Amendment with frequent occasion.
But the court has guidance from the legislative history that it can look to. If this court can construe the statute and determine that there is no issue appropriate for a jury, it's this court's duty to make that legal decision. And the legislative history indicates that the purpose of the 1959 amendments that put in 8B42B, the purpose was to foreclose picketing at secondary locations, and that Congress specifically considered the issue of other publicity and intended to protect and allow other publicity, all except picketing. And that's what we have here, although it certainly took different varieties than the publicity that was in DiBartolo.
How would a jury be instructed if this were to go to trial?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. I don't believe that would be appropriate.
I recognize that.
I understand, but that's not a question I've thought about. I'm really not prepared to comment on it. I apologize.
But there does appear to be something beyond, mm-hmm. Go back to Servet and DiBartolo, something beyond what was permitted there. That's why I keep saying there's a lot more effort. It wasn't working. What you were doing, what your clients were doing was pretty much in line with what DiBartolo and Servet involved. You know, he had additional picketing, but at the site and trying to persuade people going in and out to not go in and out, I guess. And we are, what's going on, and it's obvious there's a complete change. I know you call it delegating?
Yes, the delegations.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of describing it. I've been a delegate from a time or two, and I've also been a legislator. And when you talk about delegating, that's kind of a term that has a lot of meaning. And when you go and have a delegation go and encounter, I'm not going to say confront or harass, encounter the people on another site and kind of warn them that what they're doing, there are going to be repercussions, and it's going to be beyond picketing at the site or leafleting.
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly what happened in Servet. In Servette, the grocery stores were not the primary employer. The primary employer was the company that made these products. And the union went, you could call them delegations. The union sent people, we know there was at least one group of five, to talk to the store managers in the grocery stores and to say to them, we're asking you to stop carrying our employer's product, and if you don't, we will hand bill your store.
You're saying that you're not hand billing the store, you're hand billing the product that's in there.
We will stand in front of your store and distribute handbills.
Yeah, well.
Now, whether they specified the content of the handbills in those conversations, I don't think the decision reflects.
Well, I remember a long time ago, there was this big issue about boycotting lettuce because of whatever, maybe it's these varishvez or whatever it was. And so you would see people, I just don't buy lettuce. Okay, some people went in and didn't buy lettuce. Other people bought lettuce when they weren't otherwise going to do it, just in spite. That seems to be what was going on at Servette, that they don't buy Brock candy or whatever else it was. And maybe a lot of people went in there and weren't going to buy it anyway. And but it didn't stop going in and out of the store or doing what you do at the store. And that's what I think, really, that DiBartolo really involved. And so it was Servette. They didn't want you to. I'm not really sure what they really wanted there. It seemed to me, though, that they were protesting the store, and the store was already said, well, we're going to carry it, but maybe people won't buy it. I don't know what they said.
Several of the stores actually stopped carrying the merchandise in response to the union.
Some of it.
To handbill.
Some of it. I don't remember if it was all of it, but some of it.
Your Honor, I think it's important, it's significant to note, just as a factual matter, the union did not ask anyone to boycott any of these nine customers. I see my time is up.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Mr. Wortman, you've got 4 minutes in rebuttal. You have 4 minutes left.
If I can just elaborate on your point. A good example of what was done here that wasn't done in Servette is with Chef Bayless. The flyers that were distributed in front of Chef Bayless's restaurant and in Chef Bayless's restaurant attack his restaurant, not the hotel, his restaurant. They went into the restaurant, they met the manager, they confronted the manager and said, confronted one of the people in the business and said, we want to see the manager. When they were told the manager was unavailable, the comment was, there's always a next step. It's clear what they were doing in Chef Bayless's case. They were going to try and destroy his business until such time as housewares agreed not to use the hotel.
Well, obviously, pressure was being brought to bear, but it was all based on material in the public record, which is the problem for your claim.
Can we call it a fair and accurate? Because remember, in DiBartolo, they emphasized...
Well, that doesn't really matter. It's information that's in the public domain, whether it was being communicated in a complete and not misleading way is a separate question, but it doesn't have a bearing on the unfair labor practice issue here.
I would suggest it does, because if you read DiBartolo, it emphasized time and time again how the publications were truthful. It was wholly truthful conduct, and the court commented...
Right, there was nothing untruthful in these flyers, as I understand it. It was misleading because it was incomplete.
Correct. But
and there's the distinction between those two things.
Well, I would say at least minimally you're looking at a misleading flyer in this case versus what the Supreme Court decided to be a completely truthful flyer in DiBartolo. I think that's uncontested. But in this particular case, the misleading side of it goes straight to Chef Bayless's reputation and business. They are going after his business.
Right, and he may have a cause of action, but that's not what we're here on. We're here on your claim for violation of the unfair labor practices statute.
And I would suggest that Congress has given us a cause of action, too, under Section 8B4 by prohibiting this type of coercive activity. Not only does Chef Bayless have a cause of action that he did not exercise, but we do. But when you look at what Chef Bayless, what the importance of what happened in Chef Bayless is not just the misleading element of the flyer, but immediately after housewares found out they were taking an attack against a guest celebrity who was going to appear at the housewares show, they canceled everything. That's what the causal effect was of that particular incident was. And that's what makes this case so much more egregious than what happened in Servette and what happened in DiBartolo. It is the they basically said, we are going to, we're threatening to go after your business and what you're about if you don't cancel, if you don't get housewares to cancel their room block at the Congress Hotel. There's always a next step. Those words resonate with, in my opinion, with regard to just what they were really trying to do in this case. In connection with your point, Your Honor, I would agree with you that in 2008, things changed, and the union announced that they were changed. They indicated that what was being done up until that point wasn't effective, and that following the labor laws in this country isn't going to get you necessarily what you want. And that's when they came out with a coordinated plan with what I call code terms, flying squads, phone banks, delegations. Those are all just soft terms for describing just the massive engineering that took place here. The attacks on the businesses, they're describing as delegations. Well, again, I describe that as a soft term about what just took place. When you inundate somebody's phone line in the course of 6 hours, as they did with the top model case, and fill up his voicemail, you're not trying to send a message. There's no objective expressive intent. What you're trying to do is disrupt his business, and they did it.
I have one question. This is just mostly a curiosity, and that is the people who are on strike. Obviously, there are people working at the hotel. Are these all non-union members or people that they accuse your company of paying $5 less than everywhere else?
So we actually have several unions in the hotel.
Housekeepers, what?
There are several unions in the hotel, electrical and a few other unions, but the housekeepers are subcontracted out. That's a subcontracting agency.
Well, who's on strike?
No one's on strike any longer. In fact, in footnote one of our opening brief, in May of 2013, the union indicated they were returning all the members back to work. And then in November of 2013, the union disclaimed interest. They no longer represent anyone at the hotel. The strike is over.
The union doesn't want to represent them anymore, you say?
Disclaim their interest. They do not represent any of the workers at the hotel any longer.
So this thing is, we're looking at hindsight then, huh?
Hindsight, but we're looking at a substantial damage claim.
Yeah, I understand. Okay.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. Thanks to both counsel.